Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Hi, Rob Greaves here, and it's great to have you join Howard Freeman and myself on Listen to Older Voices, as I talk with Howard about his life in this, part two of a three-part program. In part one, we learned that from the age of four, 65-year-old Harold has been exposed to and participated in the Australian music business, both as a venue operator, a venue owner, a band manager, stage manager and production manager for shows that were developed for small local groups right through to major Australian groups such as Sherbet, Dragon, Jimmy Barnes, The Divinals, Midnight Oil, just to name a few. And then there's the major international acts that we include but are not limited to Barbara Streisand, Bruce Springsteen, Diana Ross, Harry Connick Jr., Jose Carreras, Luciano Pavarotti, Paul McCartney and two tours by the Rolling Stones. However, Howard's story is not just a list of artists and groups and facts and figures, although some of these are impressive, such as his calculation that he's flown at least 6.5 million kilometres and spent 2 years in airport lounges, all due to working with and for music and the artists. His story also includes how some of his shows have had a positive impact on breaking down apartheid in South Africa, and there are some wonderful stories of life on the road. Amazingly, through all of this, he has managed to be married for 42 years and have a family. We pick up now with Howard talking about his world tours with Midnight Oil.
Midnight Oil, I worked as their stage manager on probably five world tours.
That would have been a fairly responsible and hard job, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I was one stage manager, big sets, you go to work. And you would tour the world and just work your ass off, you know. You'd party hardy and work insanely hard and get in a bus and go somewhere else and do it again, or get in a plane and land somewhere and go and do it again. It's pretty interesting.
The image that's often portrayed about the crews, be they the stage manager or just stage hands, and I don't mean and just the stage hands, was that they were not part of the actual group itself. Was that, is that true, or was it very much a bonded relationship between artists and their support crews?
Most artists have a core crew of a front of house guy, a lighting guy, a monitor guy, a backline tech, you know, video tech, whatever. They have a core crew of people that present the show. Outside that circle, you have to get local labour
right
to come and support you to unload gear, set up gear, remove the gear, pack the trucks, etc. So the core crew that travel with the act, almost family. Because when you're out on the road, the only thing you have is the people that are with you. You've left the people you love to go and do a job that sometimes you hate because it turns sideways and it bites you. So the people surrounding you, you've got to treat as your family. So if there's a family member there that's a pain in the ass, they just get extradited really quickly.
Really quickly, yeah. Midnight Oil stands out because of Peter Garrett, of course. Whenever you see a film clip or anything to do with Peter Garrett, he always was presented as a very dynamic, very erudite, intelligent person who some of us would say made a mistake going into politics. But was he really like that?
Yeah, they were intelligent guys. They have no doubt. I mean, the things they sang about, the causes they stood for. You know, we went to Canada and ended up in logging camps, you know, thought we were going to get chainsawed to death doing a concert for the people that were protesting against it.
Well, how did that come about, and why would somebody set that up?
It was just a management idea that, you know, we had a day off, we might as well
go into a
jump on a seaplane, jump on a canoe, go up a creek, you know, set up a sad gig in a forest somewhere and look after the protesters.
So in some ways your life has been not just associated with music, but associated with travel and seeing lots of countries.
Absolutely. I did a spreadsheet a while ago because I'm anally retentive with spreadsheets. I'm known as the spreadsheet king by people that work with me. And I worked out that in my life I'd flown about 6.5 million miles. I'd spent 2 years approximately of my life in airport lounges. So in a journey of, you know, probably 45 years of touring, 2 years of just sitting in airports, it's a great thing to boast about, you know.
Sitting what a in waste airports of time. Exactly. It's not fun. That's
no,
right.
It's a pain in the ass.
Did you ever have time to investigate countries, or was it really that much hard in terms of on the go all the time?
Well, realistically, when you're out there and you're working, tours are based on proximity to the next town. So if you can overnight 5 nights a week and hit the next town and keep your income streams going, yeah, you could do that. On the days you would normally have off, you'd be travel days because the sectors were quite long.
Right.
So you'd fly your freight or you'd road freight overnight and then you just hit the next town. Wherever you did have a day off, I always made a point of going out and trying to go to the worst place I could find, i.e. the Bowery in New York or Soweto in South Africa, or, you know, or the bad parts of Berlin or whatever. But I would love to go, I'd always love to go out and explore.
So you enjoyed more putting yourself in the difficult situations. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, it's if you see the underbelly of society, then society becomes even more real, you know. If you just swan around, it's quite a glamorous lifestyle. You're involved in record companies presenting awards, record companies paying for dinner, publicists telling everybody they're great, staying in reasonable accommodation, travelling reasonably well. But you go to South Africa and you see with JPY, you know, I think there were 16,000 kids.
JPY, John Paul.
Yeah. Yep. I think there were 16,000 kids at the airport first time we got there. And then you'd have a look at the ticket sales and it was still apartheid in place where if you were black, you couldn't get a front row seat. So we demanded that multiracial ticketing was available, which wasn't a popular decision in South Africa at that time. So suddenly we had the secret police following us around. And
did you get the multiracial?
Absolutely. Ticket? Absolutely. First time ever it was done in South Africa.
But not without some trauma.
No, well, we just said we wanted it and we wouldn't play without it. So promoter had to take it on board.
So in some ways, without, you know, highlighting yourself, but in some ways the music fraternity really have been at the cutting edge of bringing these things to the attention of the rest of the world and actually doing something about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Music has changed so many facets of society, you know. It gives people joy. It gives people hope. It lets people, I don't know, reflect on their lives. It's just a joyous thing to be part of, even though some days you work 20 hours a day and you're totally gutted. I mean, there is no higher high that I get than seeing doors open and the house lights go down.
Yeah.
You know, it's the drug that I thrive on.
We are talking about all the great and positive things about it, but there must be times when it just falls apart and goes wrong. Can you recall some of the what we might call the grand disasters, or even one grand disaster where it just did not work and things.
Oh, there's a whole lot of times you think you're going to die. You know, I mean, travelling through the Swiss Alps on a bus, and because, you know, the accelerator's up the front, the motor's up the back, there's linkages that join everything. A rubber grommet had gone in the accelerator and brake linkages, the accelerator froze on.
Oh.
So we're going through the Swiss Alps in a bus we couldn't stop. So basically you just sit there and go, I'm going to die. Let's have a look at this, you know. So you sit up the front and wait. You know, the driver kept it together and apparently we live because I'm sitting
here
talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, there's other moments in your life where you go to country towns and in the early days when bands were treated like bikers, they had about the same credibility in society. You get the shit hotel room.
Yeah.
You get the bad meal. You know, you'd walk down the street with the act in the era of satin and glamour and local thugs would try and punch the shit out of your act, so you'd try and save their life. I might have had shotguns put in my mouth. I've had pistols pulled on me. I've had people try and break doors down to get in the backs of gigs to punch it on with the act. You know, I've had a 44-gallon drum dropped on my head at a gig. It's been interesting.
That's pretty serious stuff.
I had 11 guys kick the shit out of me on my other one night because I caught one of them breaking into a vehicle, you know. So, yeah, it's an interesting journey.
You hand a lot of responsibility over to third parties when you're travelling, especially overseas, for instance. You pack up all your gear and you give it to an airline company or you give it to a freight company to take. Did they always do the right thing, or did you have some traumatic moments with that sort of thing?
Most of the international stuff, because there's a frequency of things that go on, and because people are professional what they do, a lot of that worked really well. I remember once with Goanna, we went across the Nullarbor and we got on the train in Adelaide, put the truck on the train, and the railways lashed the truck onto the flat deck it was on. We ended up in Perth pulling into the station and there's no truck. They took it off. Say if we got on at Port Augusta and that was the first point, well, Port Pirie, they went, oh, it's not lashed on, probably we'll take it off. We ended up on the first gig day in Perth without a drumstick, a plectrum, a toy. So it was ring a few mates in Perth and said, we'll recreate the backline we needed and the PA and the lighting we needed to do the show. And we did it,
you know. Yeah, you have to improvise, don't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah. No instances of any serious damage to equipment? Was that always pretty well looked after?
Internationally, it's always pretty good. I mean, every item you have is carnet. So a carnet is a list of values of items and origins of items with serial numbers. And what you take out of a country, you must bring back to a country. So it stops people from taking reasonable gear to places where they want it and selling it and coming back without it. So, a carnet is a legally binding document that items you take out, you've got to bring back. The unfortunate things that have happened in this country is that a PA went to Perth once in the early days of trucking. You would use trucks that you could just lay your hands on with trucking companies that would take it on board to do those runs. A PA went to Perth once and in a fridge truck, and the guy left freezer unit on. So by the time I got to Perth, it was a block. All the desks had been blown up. So, yeah, there's a few things.
But
traditionally, no, most of the gear that travels the planet is in pretty good shape.
And you're tuned to Listen to Older Voices, the program that features the stories of the activities of older people as they continue their contribution to our nation.
I've been flipping through here. There's some really quite astounding names on here. I mean, another one I couldn't sort of go past is Paul McCartney. What was your relationship with Paul?
I was site manager for Paul McCartney on his tour in Australia.
What did that involve?
Well, there were two areas with Paul McCartney. One, I was the crew chief on the sites that when they hire local labour, I was the head of the local labour. For Melbourne, we actually took that labour crew to Sydney because they couldn't get enough people in Sydney. So we actually moved the team to Sydney. I lived in the pie shed at Parramatta Stadium and we worked every day building the steel and setting up the rig and doing all of that. So it was pretty interesting. The second one was site manager for his tour, which he bailed out of, funnily enough. So we'd set everything up, had everything in place, we'd had our meetings, had all their suppliers sorted, and I think he pulled out. I know he didn't do the tour.
Did you ever work with Ike Turner?
No.
What about Tina?
Tina, we did a couple of shows with here, once again, just doing labour.
So she wasn't with Ike at that stage?
No, this is in later years. The funny thing about Tina Turner is Roger Davies, who managed Sherbet, which was the first act I toured. It actually wasn't the first act. The first one was Daddy Cool and Matt Taylor, but Sherbet was the one I did 4 or 5 years with. Roger Davies was a guy that he ate and breathed the industry. He was, like, just dedicated to it. And he ended up managing Tina, managing Joe Cocker, managing Pink, This guy's got a folio of artists that's just frightening.
Yeah, that is. You mentioned Sherbet, a very much loved and popular group in Australia, and 5 years is quite a lengthy stint. During that period, what sort of band changes happened while you were with them? Because they did go through a number of different musicians, didn't they?
Yeah, Clive left, Harvey James came on board. The rest of it stayed pretty constant. I mean, there was Gunther Gorman in and out. But the basis of Sandow, Mitchell, Porter, James and Braithwaite was the solid one that I stuck with. In saying that I did 5 years with that, it was 5 years with Roger Davies and the management company. So at the same time, I was doing John Paul Young, Rockwell T. James and other acts as well. So it just wasn't constantly Sherbet, but it was they were the formative years.
Yes.
Where we went around Australia and we took, I mean, the reality is that we'd go to Festival Hall and we had a 28-foot truck and we would build the show. Now I go to Festival Hall with Axe and I put 5 or 6 semis full of gear into it.
Yeah,
I think I wonder what's gone wrong. You know?
Sherbet used to be able to draw quite a crowd, particularly of the female species. Yeah. Did that ever create any issues for you and the crews, the popularity of the group? I mean, or were they able to keep them separated?
The hardest thing with a teenage crowd who are discovering themselves, their sexuality, their freedom, you know, this is probably the first time a lot of kids have gone out. They become a little bit insane. So getting the act in and out of venues was quite difficult. I ended up doing Maine Nicholas vans, hiring Maine Nicholas vans to back into venues to put the band in to depart the venue. Because we'd leave in hire cars and the kids would pull the mirrors off. They'd, you know, scratch the cars, write their names on it, do everything, jump in front of the car. So an armoured vehicle was basically the only way we could get in and out of some of these gigs.
Oh, I guess also must have got to the point where the hire car companies wouldn't want the gig anyway.
Because yeah, absolutely. Damaged. You know, I mean, we went to Mount Isa and Avis at that time had brought 3 brand new Fairlanes into Mount Isa for us to drive around in. My front of house guy, Tosh, got a bit pissed, asked for the car keys and said he was going kangaroo hunting. He brought the car back in the morning. It was covered in blood and fur and a broken windscreen. I said, I thought you were going kangaroo hunting. He said, I did. So that was sort of the end of that relationship with Avis.
I bet it was too. You're on the road so often and even when you're not on the road, there's so much going on in your life in terms of music and venues and things like this. Did you have time for relationships?
Oh, absolutely. I found a beautiful woman in the queue at Q Club when I was about 20.
Her name?
Lil, who I'm currently married to. We're celebrating 42 years.
That's quite an achievement in this day and age, which when relationships seem to form and break up very quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, a very understanding woman, very strong woman. Basically brought up the kids because I was on the road. The joke is that, you know, in 42 years I've probably been home for 15.
Yeah, I can understand that. Yes.
And I think by doing this you become... I mean, coming out of a generation of promoters and watching my father at breakfast reading the paper and having a scotch and water, I decided that, like, when I was home with the kids, I wouldn't pick up the paper, you know. I'd spend the time I would spend with my family when I could get it was special.
How many kids do you have?
We've got 2 boys. Paul, who's now 39 and running a staging company, and Lee, who's 35 and is a production manager and does shows with me.
Weird stuff talking about your children being 35 and 39, isn't it?
Fourth generation, you know.
That's right.
And
that's,
I mean, right. If you go through the whole thing of we've worked in the entertainment business for 111 years, we really haven't had a day job.
No.
You know? No. It's a strange thing. It's like circus.
When the kids were little and you were still that busy, did they ever give you the message that they were missing their dad, or did they understand from a young age?
I think they bonded with their mother so well. Yeah, there's moments where the kids would miss you and you'd miss them, and
sure,
it'd be obvious. But like saying, if you try and make the time you've got together quality time, it makes up for, if you're just going to be boring for 7 days a week, you might as well not be there anyway.
It's true.
You know?
Yeah. Okay, let's get back to Lil. A lot of people enjoy hearing about relationships, especially ones that are enduring like yours, 42 years. That is special. When you first saw Lil, was there an instant attraction or did it grow?
Oh, absolutely. I just looked at her and went, that's the one.
She was
I was in a relationship at the time. The girl I was going out with was actually dancing at the gig I was running. She was one of the dancers on stage.
And Lou was just in the audience, was she?
Yeah, I knew her brother. I mean, I knew her brother from Northcote, and I just looked at this girl and went, that's the one.
That's the one.
That's the one. And relentlessly pursued her.
For what period of time?
Oh.
Before it got serious?
A few months, you know. I mean, basically, I think the first time I saw her, I wanted to marry her and probably asked her. Then I said, let's get engaged. And she was like, can you wait till I'm 18? You know.
What about her parents? What did they think of all this?
They were probably a bit nonplussed because in that era, you know, her dad was a metal polisher. He's of Welsh descent. Her mother was a housewife in Northcote. So for this guy who probably came from the other side of the city, turning up in a Renault 10 with hair down to his ass and a beard, where the normal guy would turn up with the crew cut and driving an FJ. It was all a bit different. Mm. But I sort of spun the magic by, you know, bringing flowers and opening doors, and which is just the way I was brought up.
And the right thing to do.
Yeah. But it sort of worked. And I love them both dearly. I mean, as I said, my father died when I was 18. Lil's father died a few years ago, but he was actually a father to me longer than my own father was.
Yes, yes.
And he gave me some real good life lessons and set some good standards. Great people.
And this is Listen to Older Voices, a program that presents the stories of everyday Australians through the recollection of their lives.
Let's talk about just a bit in the past, when the highlight years, you know, as you said, you've given me this list here, between the 80s and 90s and into the year 2000, there's an awful lot of work going on. When you and Lil do have time together, what do you do for enjoyment? What do you do together?
We socialise with friends. We work on the place we live in. We go to the gym. We go and see bands. We'll go, you know, we'll just do anything. We'll go to the movies. It's a normal, solid relationship. You know, just to be together is terrifyingly good.
I like the way you put that. You do a lot of travel in your work. Do you and Lil do any travel together in terms of your just social life?
We just got back about 6 weeks ago from 6 weeks in Europe. So it's always been a thing where Lil go, I've just been to Europe. What's Frankfurt like? I go, shit hole, because you'd only remember it as getting off a plane or a bus and going to a gig and getting back on a plane or a bus and leaving town. And you remember the venue, you remember a little bit of the city, but. You know, there's nothing significant. So it was sort of interesting to go back and visit a few places that I've worked and look at them in a totally different light and just turn up as a tourist. It was great fun.
Do you have a favourite country or even a favourite place?
To work?
No, to visit. Yeah, to visit.
Italy, to me, is breathtaking. I mean, France is fantastic, but the French are a bit busy being too French. Where the Italians actually, they just gesticulate with their hands, they laugh more, they embrace more, you know. They're just a more basic, comfortable, happy human being.
Personable people.
Absolutely. I think the Spanish get it a bit too, but I think the Italians are a great race of people.
What places have you visited that you've gone, okay, won't bother going back there again? Has there been such a place? Or is everything you see now, you're seeing through different eyes?
Not particularly. I mean, most places I've been where even we had a hard time. I mean, you know, you go to Bangkok and there's a military curfew on, but you would get around that because the promoter was the colonel in the army, so you'd be riding in jeeps after curfew time, you know. You go to the airport to export your freight. And you'd, you know, have a drink of Thai whiskey with the security guys or the army guys, and they'd let you fire their machine guns off if you gave them, you know, a souvenir of the tour. You know, it was sort of a strange world.
So you've had to develop a lot of sort of skills, not just involved in the music business, but interpersonal skills in terms of dealing with authority.
Absolutely. Still do.
Are you still working in the business?
Right now.
Yeah.
I finished Soundwaves Festival this year in March, decided to take some time out. Currently I'm setting up the One Direction tour for next year, which is a major stadium tour, 65,000 capacities.
Yeah.
I've been working on that off and on for about 8 months. I've just come back from a three-day recce around the country with their production manager and the promoter. I went to the States for a couple of weeks and visited them and saw how they operated and... Yeah.
What impressions did you get from the States visit?
How big it is. I mean, everybody looks at One Direction as this sad boy band, you know, and dismisses them. What they miss is that they've sold 46 million units of product, that they do 60,000, 70,000 capacity venues, that their lighting, video and set is bigger than the Stones or as big as the Stones and U2. It's that ilk. It's like doing something that big.
I have
it is
to,
huge.
Yeah, I have to admit, being in the generation, your generation, my association with the group is probably not the same as I had with the Stones and those other groups. So you're right. I do tend to dismiss them.
Yeah, absolutely. Just another boy band. But that is the buying public that's out there.
Right.
You know, they will do better figures than the Eagles potentially. You know, I'm not bagging the Eagles, but I'm just saying the demographic is what it is. You know, those kids will buy tickets because that's their first adventure. This is like Sherbet Revisited. There's something quite incongruous about a 65-year-old man running a gig for 12-year-old girls, isn't it?
It's a bit weird. That's right. You know? It is a bit weird, but then again, you've got to have had that experience and that knowledge to do it, don't you?
Absolutely. And the reason I got this gig anyway was because I've done enough, without being a big head, big shows.
Yeah.
So when the promoter looked around for somebody to do it, they gave me a call and I went, yeah, sure, I'll have a go at it.
Yeah.
Because I think Nine Live as a promoter is a new generation of promoter that get it, will be honourable. They're a publicly listed company. They'll look after paying the little guy first, which I totally endorse.
Yeah.
You know?
I invite you to join Howard next week for the third and final part of his story, which is not just more of what he's done, but includes a wonderful discussion of why live music, live Australian music, is so important to our culture and our way of life. That's next week, Howard Freeman on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.